Hello and welcome to a special program of INSS podcast series following our international conference, National Security, Strategic Communications and Truth Decay in a Contested Information Environment that was held in the beginning of November. We will discuss some of the topics on the agenda of the conference with experts that participated in it. The conference was arranged by the Lipkin-Shahak Program, National Security and Democracy in an Era of Post-Truth and Fake News. Strategic communications, this is our next topic, and we will discuss it with Dr. Neville Bolt, Director of King's College Center for Strategic Communications. Hello, sir.
Hello.
So first of all, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with this field of research, what is strategic communications?
Let me give you a couple of ways of looking at it. One, very simply, in a nutshell, it is about the shifting and shaping of major discourses that have implications in the future. One that is more detailed is to say, well, it is the projection of foreign and security policy by governments aimed at targeted audiences with the objective of achieving strategic effects, namely changes in attitude and behavior of those targeted audiences. And some people would say it is in the national interest. I would say it's in the national interest or in the interest of a political community. Because if it's in the national interest, it suggests only states do strategic communications. I think other political movements do strategic communications. So I'm thinking about the difference, for example, between, if I asked you, do you think Al-Qaeda does strategic communications? Do you think Daesh, ISIS, ISIL did strategic communications? Well, if strategic communications is limited to states, then Al-Qaeda doesn't qualify. But ISIS does, because it was an embryonic state, even though it only lasted as a state, as an organic being, for a year or two. By state, I mean an entity that administers a population and offers monopoly over legitimate violence, social security, healthcare, judiciary, policing, those basics that we associate with a state. So you can see that strategic communications also, in that sense, is still controversial, because some people say, no, only states do it. Some people say only Western states do it, because it's about democracy. And others say, no, major political players in the world also do strategic communications. You don't have to be a state. That's a very long way of trying to explain a very short question. I'm sorry.
That's fine. So maybe we'll talk about the implications of strategic communications all around the world. And you can give us a surely well-known example.
Okay.
About Russia and Western states.
Okay. In March 2018, in the United Kingdom, in a small town called Salisbury, a former Russian spy, a former Russian double agent, and his daughter were nearly killed, murdered, by what appears to have been two members of Russia's military intelligence. They came into contact with a poison, high-grade poison that emanates from military sources. The response to it by the British government was a measured response, a careful response, but it had to be quite a quick response as well, And in the meantime, as the government was trying to collect evidence, where had this poison come from? Who were the likely perpetrators? Meanwhile, Russia started to put out stories saying, well, it could be this, it could be that. 3 months later, coming out of Moscow and St. Petersburg, there had been something like 43 different explanations, which were completely different. And there was a very clear strategy going on. And the strategy was, it wasn't about any of those individual 43 messages that Russia was putting out. It was about all of them. The idea was to subvert the political status quo, creating to a certain extent chaos. Where the strategic communications, so that was the kind of, you might say, a strategic opportunist view of strategic communications coming out of Moscow. The British response was to say, we have to test it, but it is highly likely, not proven, but highly likely that it came out of Russia. The result of all this was that there was a kind of tit for tat that developed. Britain expelled Russian diplomats. Washington expelled Russian diplomats. European Union countries did the same. Russia, in return, expelled British diplomats and closed down the British Council. This projects it onto an international stage, clearly, because it takes it out of Britain and it disseminates it across supportive Western democratic states who feel under threat. But the whole package becomes part of a strategic communications project, if you think about it like that. In a less specific way, and one which Western states are currently struggling to come to terms with, is the rise of China. And there are two elements to that. Because Western states are trying to work out, what is it that China is trying to do? What is China actually trying to say when it speaks to the world? Because there are two things happening. One is the Belt and Road Initiative, One Belt, One Road, which the Chinese president already in 2014 was saying, this is the biggest global soft power project since the Marshall Plan in the 1940s, 50s, that came out of the United States. And that we, China, are doing this for the benefit of the world to generate trade, because what they were doing was creating new Silk Roads, as opposed to the old Silk Roads, that stretched all the way from China, all the way to Western Europe, through Central Asia, Eastern Europe to Western Europe. This all sounds good. This sounds like good diplomacy, public diplomacy. On the other hand, in the East China Sea and in the South China Sea, China is exerting its territorial ambitions, and it says its territorial sovereignty through kinetic military naval clashes in the East China Seas and South China Seas with the Japanese, but also exerting claims on territory, waters, parts of the sea, the ocean, vis-a-vis the Philippines, vis-a-vis Vietnam, and so on. So what appears on the kinetic side, on the side of, let's call it hard force, appears to be quite a bellicose, or at least a militarized China trying to exert its power. On the other side, you have what appears to be a very friendly China trying to exert economic regeneration of the global economy. When you put them together, what are you looking at? This is the difficulty. So, put in short, do we in the West think China are the good guys or the bad guys, if you put it into really brutal terms? And we're struggling to understand that because what we're looking at is ambiguity. And it's not clear. The Russian situation is pretty clear because Putin has repeatedly shown that his ambitions are purely for rebuilding a Russian empire. And that can only be done at the expense of Western states.
So last but not least, if you can just shortly say some words about the challenges for democracies in view of these events that you've just mentioned.
The challenges for Western democracies really go to a different point. And for strategic communicators, it's important to try to see a picture that stretches across the world. Democracies are on the back foot. They're being pushed, they're being threatened, and they're being infiltrated by authoritarian regimes. So China, again, President of China has said on more than one occasion, democracy as a form of governance is no longer fit for purpose. Democracy has had its time. It's had its 200 years in the sunshine. Complex modern societies require more authoritarian, more controlled forms of administration. And that kind of thinking is being pressed onto the world through China's economic leverage and its diplomatic initiatives. In Eastern Europe, you have democracies who sit within the European Union, but are effectively not maybe as far as Russia has gone, where democracy, they do have elections in Russia, but nobody believes that in them at all. In Eastern Europe, you have states which use the tools of democracy, but actually are very much more focused on strongman politics. So it is an illiberal form of democracy. And then there's the rest of us who are internally struggling with what we've always understood as democracy and where the democracy is being re-examined internally for a variety of reasons. So if you look at Spain, look at the, you know, Barcelona protests and see what effect that's having on democracy and questions around democracy. You know, look at Greece, same thing over the last few years. Look at the United Kingdom and Brexit. There you have two forms of democracy going head to head. Direct democracy, brackets, referendum, versus versus representative democracy, brackets, parliamentary democracy. So democracy is being questioned by democratic citizens and electorates. The net effect of that is that the conversation around democracy and democratic governance is probably, and I think it's quite right that it always should be, but at the moment, it is the most burning issue. And we have to address it.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our podcast series. We will discuss now the issue of Russian disinformation campaigns and other related topics with Todd C. Helmus, Senior Behavioral Scientist at the RAND Corporation. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So, what threats do Russian disinformation campaigns pose to national security in the United States and Europe?
Well, based on evidence from the U.S. election in 2016, as well as the European Union parliamentary election and others, we're seeing a very strong Russian efforts to use social media to try and influence, not only influence the outcome of those elections, and when I say influence the outcome, not only influence how people vote, but attempting to suppress voter behavior, which is sort of well established in the United States. But then, as part of this content, they're attempting to do other things, right? So including broader efforts at fragmenting society And in the U.S., examples of that, there was content arguing for Black Lives Matter, content arguing for Police Lives Matter, efforts to sort of create separate or foment separate camps within American society. Even in Ireland, they're apparently trying to sow diffusion by promoting Catholics and Protestants against each other and trying to disrupt that society. So that's a key goal. And they're also trying to promote broader distrust in institutions. I think the more that they can build distrust in facts, in reality, in who am I listening to, who am I talking to, are the elections real, are the elections not real, all of that serves to weaken sort of a key fabric of society, which I think is to Russia's advantage. And then, of course, there's sort of broader efforts, and maybe this is more for Europe, but efforts to weaken connections between some European states and their members and the European Union. Efforts to foment distrust and disconnection between Russian nationals who live in Eastern Europe in places like Estonia, Latvia, and Ukraine, and the European countries to which they belong, as well as to broader NATO and Europe. So all of that is working, I think, to fragment societies, to, which would be, I think, their goal.
So you mentioned elections and efforts to intervene during the elections, but does this phenomenon can be also effective during day-to-day interactions between human beings, between parts of the society, and the efforts to divide the society by concentrating, for example, on special events, dramatic events that occur during political processes or even during deterioration of the security conditions in a certain state. Are there any other forms of intervention that the Russian disinformation campaigns are focused on?
Part of the challenge, too, with this is that we don't even, I think, fully know the extent of Russia's efforts or other state efforts, for that matter. It all sort of hinges on our ability and oftentimes the ability of Facebook or Twitter to detect this content and to raise this content in the public sphere. And so I think we're still lacking on the true potential extent of the ability of Russia to influence different sectors of society.
Okay, let's speak about efforts to counter disinformation campaigns. What, in your opinion, are the most effective methods that states like the United States and European states use? And are there any ideas about how to improve these methods?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge here is what are the effective methods? And I don't think we know really what are the effective methods. I think the first order of defense is the platforms themselves, right? So we're sort of hiring off our defense to Facebook and Twitter and hoping that they have our best interest at heart and are seeking to and undertaking significant efforts to identify this content on their platforms. So obviously, Facebook recently identified and removed various different pages that Russia had been using to influence different states in Africa, populations in Africa, with the notion that that was sort of a Russia's testing their tactics out for potential Western as well as maybe even Israeli elections per se. Removing the content is key. I think Twitter's prohibition of not accepting political ads may be an interesting first start on some of this areas because, to the extent that Twitter is in fact able to remove political content from their advertising reams, then I think it takes away one potential tool from away from Russia in that regard. There's also various techniques, and I think the question of how effective these are is unclear, and they're certainly long-standing initiatives, right? So trying to improve journalism, improve investigative journalism, mm-hmm. Especially in areas like Eastern Europe where there might not be a culture or a capability of investigative journalism to sort of identify unfacts as they are. Expanding local content in some of those areas. So like my study is on Russian influence in Eastern Europe, and so I think along those lines, But, you know, Russia owns a lot of the content, Russian language content that's being streamed out to populations in Eastern Europe. So finding alternative ways of having Russian language populations gain access to their content. And I think more broadly, United States and Europe and elsewhere is this notion of media literacy. So building, can we build resilience in our population to identify facts, to prioritize facts over feelings or anecdote in performing analyses and doing analyses or looking at public policies? And it's just, you know, thinking about just being able to judge the content that you're sharing with your friends. And this is a long-term education initiative that I think will take some time to produce results. But to the extent that our education systems have not been up to the task, then obviously they need to be improved. And then finally, I think telling the broader U.S.-European story, you know, to the extent that Russia has an interest in breaking apart Europe, the European Union, disconnecting populations from their support for the European Union, or even NATO for that matter. Think about then the extent to which the European Union or NATO or even the U.S. can better tell their story to those populations to make it harder for Russia to pull them apart.
So we would like to refer to another issue, not the disinformation campaigns per se, but violent extremism, which spreads on the same platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and which may also may lead to terror activities, as we have witnessed during the last years. Is it possible to counter this phenomenon by those tools that are available for states to counter disinformation campaigns or any other methods? And to what extent do you think we can affect, we, the states, can affect the incentives of those who participate in violent extremism on the web?
Yeah, I think the Islamic State has sort of pointed the way in terms of how to use these technologies. You know, what did the Islamic State do really well? Well, first, they seem to really take advantage of Twitter as a platform to reach out to masses of audiences. And they not only had a compelling message that they could tell their audiences, a message that their audiences gravitated toward naturally, but they relied on key influencers within the Islamic State, fighters, to go out on Twitter and communicate on the organization's behalf. And so people could follow these fighters in real time, which was exciting, I imagine. They were able to use Twitter to recruit new members. And to identify prospective recruits. So when someone might tweet in support of the Islamic State, they sort of automatically self-identify themselves as a potential recruit. I mean, when is the last time you've seen a terrorist organization be able to recruit at such a scale? And I think Twitter really allowed them to do that. And so when someone self-identified, they could reach out to that individual through direct message or direct chat and then recruit them. Or begin conversations. I think all those things sort of point a way forward for how to counter ISIS. One, relying on key influencers. The United States and others rely on efforts to train local activists to help better use social media to counter the Islamic State. There's also the use of advertising techniques, such as on Google AdWords, to identify individuals searching for extremist content and to place ads in front of them. And then finally, I think a big key is on the Twitter, on the platform side, to suspend accounts that are violating terms of service, promoting violence, promoting terrorist organizations, and what have you. And really, I think the biggest thing that reduced Islamic State's influence on the web was Twitter suspensions.
And regarding the phenomenon of the lone wolves, I mean, do you think anything can be done to identify them, to actually track their activities ahead, so to prevent terror activities?
Maybe. I think the challenge is if they're pretty decent at masquerading their activities, and most, I think, folks are smart enough now not to go live on Twitter and pronounce their affinity for the Islamic State. I think it's hard to do so, unless they're just bad at operational security, in which case they might be easy to track.
Okay, thank you very much. Our next discussion will focus on Brazil and the impact of strategic communications in the context of the relations of Brazil with other states in Latin America. For this regard, we would like to say hello to Dr. Vinicius Mariano de Carvalho, Senior Lecturer in Brazilian Studies at King's College London.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
So, strategic communications and the relevance of this issue to the Amazon fires is the topic that you presented during our conference. How did the government of Brazil react to the crisis, and what lessons can we learn from this story about the importance of strategic communication?
So, probably all over the world, people have heard about the fires in the Amazon in 2019, in August 2019. It became very quickly an international commotion and a global concern about the conditions of safety of the Amazonia and the risk that the damage of the jungle would have for global warming or even to global climate change. When the thing started, for the Brazilian point of view, was just something that happened every year as part of a natural process of people that live close to the jungle to put fire in parts of their land, to plantations, to clean the areas with fire. It's something that happened constantly in Brazil. Some years, those fires are higher than other years, depending on the capability of the government and the wish of the government of tackle there and stop that. And also depending on the force that the industry, especially the agribusiness, has to increase their areas of plantation too. So this year particularly was a peak after long period of systematic and de-escalation or reduction of those fires. This year we had a peak in August that were noticed by the Brazilian agents for space research. And the government neglected and even denied that in the beginning as being something from the opposition. Well, consequently, that started to get a more international attention and an international discussion. What was a simple fact that happened constantly every year in Brazil suddenly became an international crisis. And the lack of a coordinate communication strategy process by the Brazilian government helped or create more problems than solutions in this case. So conflictual messages sent by the government, conflictual also response to what was being said internationally, and especially reacting very aggressively to what other governments were saying, it helped also to inflame the discussion and the communication process around this fact of the fires.
How come? Why?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer. This is a very very complex process to analyze quickly, but mostly because, first of all, we can only talk about strategic communication if we have a grand strategy in place, in line. The case of the Amazon is lots of discourses being disputed about what means Amazonia for Brazil, the jungle, the rainforest, the bioma, what means that to Brazil. It's a lot of conflictual and dispute discourses about Amazonia. With this dispute of discourses, there is not a clear strategy that would be a grand strategy or a national goal to the Amazonia. And consequently, it's very difficult to create one linear or at least a consistent and coherent discourse about that. So, three points are important to keep in mind here. First of all, in one side, there is the economic interests on the Amazonia. It's a fantastic resource of minerals. It is still lots of biodiversity that were not explored, and we don't know what could be used from that. It's the largest reservoir of drinkable water in the planet. So it is a very rich area and belongs to Brazil. So that's the economic side of it. The second side is exactly this one, the sovereignty aspect of it. The Brazilian Amazonia It's important to say that the biome Amazon is not only Brazilian. Colombia, Venezuela, Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia, they have also parts of this rainforest, this biome Amazonia. So we have this other side, is the sovereignty of Brazil in what is Brazilian Amazonia, that is unquestionable. And Brazil will never accept any sort of international interference on how to deal with that. And the third point of that, it has to do also with the local population living there and what's their voice about their own place. And I'm talking here about the riverine population and the indigenous people living there, basically. So with this confluence of different discourses, it's very difficult to find a unified way of communicate an issue like those fires. No? So because of that, because of a lack of a coherent addressing of what's the Amazonia, the conflicts of discourses provoked this crisis that we saw, that the Brazilian government was impossible or incapable of respond actively to what were being demanded from the international arena in response to these fires.
So let's speak more broadly about the challenges that Brazil faces and the efforts to cope with these challenges by discourse or by strategic communications. What in particular is the role of information and information sharing in constructing the policy and the methods of coping with those challenges also in the field of security?
Yeah, well, talking about information and information sharing, we inevitably will need to talk now about the fake news and how this is impacting a lot the idea of what is to be informed about. Brazil, as many other parts of the globe in general, are being arena for this fake news. And it's been very difficult to make a distinction of what is fact, what is fake. This is one of the topics of our conference also here, to discuss the role of this fake news in trying to build up a more consistent narratives or communication strategy tools to deal with national security issues. So Brazil is coming from a period of 30 years of a new constitution, let's say like that. It's not so new anymore, but it was a constitution that came just after a military regime in Brazil that for 20 some years made very restrictive access to the information with censorship, with state control. And suddenly the constitution, that it opened a lot and gave a lot of sense for a more democratic participation in the country. And the country start to grow around that. But when we had the confrontation with the accessibility of social media, and in which every single one has a lot to say and wants to share that, it became very difficult to differentiate what are just an opinion to what is factual issues. So this is implying that Brazilian is facing a very challenging moment now because of this process of a new model or a new experience of dealing with information. So Brazilian president, as many other politicians in Brazil, they are very active in social media, especially Twitter, that provokes a lot of non-reflexive or non-reflective expressions. Consequently, it's very difficult again to build up one coherent narrative for the country in general. So I think we are living a very intense battlefield of information and communication in which the parameters of this battle, it's not very clear. It's a very dirt battle that parameters are not clearly defined. So therefore, it's difficult to say how to build up something solid when we don't have clear ideas about what's been said.
So before we end, just a couple of words about the relations between Brazil and Israel, also in the context of information sharing and coping with these challenges that you mentioned, and maybe also on the security level, is there any effect for all these processes that you analyzed on the relations between both states and the challenges that they have to face?
Well, Brazil and Israel relations, I think they are tied by a foundational spirit. It was a Brazilian Minister of Foreign Affairs who led the United Nations vote for the creation of the State of Israel, Oswaldo Aranha. And we are very proud of that as Brazilians, to be part of this foundational spirit of the State of Israel. And this relationship has been developed over the years very positively. And in the point of view of cooperation, especially nowadays on security and defense issues, it's been very strong and very solid developed since last year, especially when Brazil and Israel, or even before, since the World Cup and the Olympic Games, a close collaboration between both countries in security measures, Israeli technology and also expertise. Helped a lot Brazil to build up its own doctrines for mega events and for security in situations like the World Cup and the Olympic Games demanded. Also, the exchange in technological development, there are lots of collaborations between Brazilian companies and Israeli companies for systems development, especially with satellites and with missiles, and also Air Force radars, airplane radars. So it is a very solid one, and especially, as I said, since last year, Brazil is approaching more Israel and vice versa to try to consolidate a more stable and long-term cooperation that would benefit both countries in this matter of security and defense. Also in the sharing of information and data and the worries about cybersecurity. The two countries are working together in order to be more proactive, collaborative in the sense.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's the end of the program. We hope you enjoyed it. For more programs, please enter our English website, www.inss.org.il, and press on the tab podcast. Thanks and goodbye.